From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a new novel about penitence and forgiveness. We talk with Dorothy Allison, the author of Bastard Out of Carolina. Her new book, Cave Dweller, is the story of an abused woman who abandons her children and later comes back to recover them and reconstruct her life. Also, playwright David Henry Hwang tells us about his newest production opening on Broadway next month. Golden Child is based on the stories his Chinese grandmother told him when he was a young boy. Hwang is best known for the Broadway hit M. Butterfly. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Madonna's new CD. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The U.S. Supreme Court today upheld California's term limits law. The decision may affect challenges to term limits in several other states. NPR's Stephen Rosenfeld reports.
California was one of the first states to adopt the limits on how long public officials can serve in office. The state's voters passed its term limits law in 1990. The California law has been the target of several lawsuits, the most recent by a mix of legislators and voters who argued that term limits violated the public's right to choose candidates and that voters didn't realize they were creating a lifetime ban. Late last year, a federal appeals court rejected those claims and let the term limits stand. And today, the Supreme Court agreed, issuing its decision without comment. In California, candidates have been campaigning for several months under the assumption the law would be upheld. Legal challenges to term limits laws in Arkansas, Michigan, Oregon, and Florida are not expected to be helped by today's ruling. Stephen Rosenfeld, NPR News, San Francisco, California.
The Supreme Court justices also declined today to hear an invalidated Ohio law that bans a certain type of late-term abortion. The vote was 6-3. The decision let stand rulings that call the Ohio law unconstitutional and block its enforcement. The decision is not a court ruling and sets no precedent. Russian President Boris Yeltsin unexpectedly fired his whole cabinet today, including Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin. NPR's Andy Bowers reports from Moscow.
In one of his trademark bombshells, Yeltsin announced that he had fired Chernomyrdin and asked him to take over preparations for the next presidential election in 2000. Yeltsin stopped short of saying Chernomyrdin himself should be a candidate for president, and the former prime minister refused to say whether he intends to run. Chernomyrdin did stress, however, that this is not a political crisis, and both he and Yeltsin said economic reforms will continue. Yeltsin says he wants a more decisive government to carry out those reforms. Also among today's casualties is Deputy Prime Minister Anatoly Chubais, the chief architect of Russia's move toward a market economy. Chubais, however, says he will remain on Yeltsin's team in some role. The president has named another young reformer, Sergei Kiryenko, to the post of acting prime minister while he selects a permanent replacement. Andy Bowers, NPR News, Moscow.
President Clinton is on the first leg of his African tour. He is in Ghana, where he addressed an estimated 500,000 people today in Accra, the Ghanaian capital. The president said that the United States will work to promote trade and democracy with African nations in order to create a new Africa. During his speech, Mr. Clinton walked along a barricade in the city center, shaking hands. At one point in Independence Square, a barricade collapsed, and Mr. Clinton was forced to yell at people to back up. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 52 points at 8,853. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is retreating from record highs. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner has details from New York.
The Dow's decline is being led by Walt Disney, which is lower after Barron's magazine reported the company's profit in the past five quarters has been enhanced by a secret reserve of as much as $2.5 billion. Without it, Barron says, Disney's profit gain would have been 10% versus the 25% the company reported in fiscal 1997. And shares in Boeing are down after the Wall Street Journal reported that new production bottlenecks are delaying more than 50 of its latest 737 aircraft. The problems include part shortages and unexpected modification demands by European and U.S. safety regulators. On the positive side, international oil issues are following the price of crude oil higher after some of the world's largest oil producers unexpectedly agreed to cut output by as much as 2 million barrels a day. I'm Doug Krisner.
The Associated Press is reporting the Justice Department has decided to file a lawsuit blocking Lockheed Martin's $8.5 million acquisition of Northrop Grumman Corporation. The suit will be filed in Washington District Court. Over the weekend, a last-minute restructuring offer by the companies failed to meet government objections. German media conglomerate Bertelsmann says it will buy the biggest American book publisher, Random House. Bertelsmann already owns Bantam Doubleday Dell and is looking to expand its English-language consumer publishing business. The combined publishing business will keep the Random House names. Some authors who have been published by Random House include Michael Crichton, Norman Mailer, and John Updike. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Dorothy Allison's best-selling first novel, Bastard Out of Carolina, told the story of an abused child growing up in South Carolina in the 60s. It was based on her own life story. Now, in her new book, Cave Dweller, Allison explores the aftermath of domestic abuse in a Southern family in this decade. Dorothy Allison has written explicitly about her life, her childhood abuse, and her lesbian sexuality in both her essays and poetry. She's now raising a son with her partner, Alex. In her new novel, Cave Dweller, the main character Delia is a recovering alcoholic who fled her native town of Cairo, Georgia, to avoid almost certain death at the hands of her violent husband. She left behind two small daughters. After a marriage and a career as a singer for a rock band in L.A., Delia returns to Cairo a decade later to recover her lost children and redeem her past. She brings with her daughter Sissy from her second marriage. Here's Dorothy Allison reading from the beginning of her novel, Cave Dweller.
Emptying the closets of the little cottage, Delia picked at the raw sore of her conscience. It had been 10 years. Her girls, Dee Dee and Amanda, they were not babies. They were 11, 13, nearly grown. What if they didn't hate her? What if her girls hoped for her as much as she hoped for them? From what if she fell to maybe, then to might be, could be, oh God, surely so. It was the way she thought when she was drinking, as detached from the real as anything could be. It was the voice in the back brain, the voice that swore one drink wouldn't kill her and another was all right, too. The devil or desperation, that voice, whispered steadily, drew her on. Delia swore she would never drink again, but her girls were not liquor. Her girls were real. Cairo was real. Cairo was home. Maybe no one could earn forgiveness. But listening to that whisper, Delia Bird packed everything she owned and decided to try.
Dorothy Allison, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you.
I find it interesting that right in the beginning of your book, you set up this situation for Delia, that when you've fallen so low or so far in your life, there's almost no way to distinguish hope from self-delusion. Is that how you saw the book beginning?
That's not only how I saw the book, it's how I see my life. Yes. I wanted her at rock bottom, up against the wall, had to decide to change her life. And I think that that opening just pushes her over, triggers everything that follows.
Now, eventually, this whole family ends up living together. Delia, her daughter Sissy from her second marriage, and her two daughters from her first marriage. And they live with her first husband, who is dying of cancer and who has made a pact to help Delia get her daughters back if Delia helps him die. This is all really enormously complicated. What interested you about bringing these women together under these fractured circumstances?
Well, what I wanted to write was a novel about forgiveness, a novel about repentance and how do you make amends, which is very, I know lots of people do that, but I have seen people forgive each other. I wasn't sure that I believed it ever really happens. I wasn't sure I believed in forgiveness. So I had to, in order to figure it out, I had to write it out. And I wanted it to see if Delia could be forgiven, because I think she has committed an unforgivable sin in abandoning her daughters. And I wanted to see if her husband Clint could be forgiven, because I think his sin is unforgivable as well. I don't think they forgive each other, but I think that in the course of trying to work through this, they earn a kind of redemption for the children and for themselves.
I really like in the beginning of the book when Delia takes off for her hometown of Cairo, Georgia, with her daughter to recover her two daughters from her first marriage. She ends up in a diner right inside Cairo, and a waitress is waiting on them. The waitress is real sweet. There's a real Southern hospitality thing going on. But then the cook leans out of the kitchen and says she recognizes Delia. She says, yeah. I know you. You should do it. You have the accent down. What did she say?
Well, Delia, of course, immediately assumes that she recognizes her from Mud Dog, which is how she became famous as this kind of second-rank blues and rock and roll singer. But the cook recognizes her as that woman that ran off and left her babies. And, you know, calls her name in the middle of the diner. Everybody looks up. It's that kind of public crucifixion that we all hope we never have to endure. And she does it in front of the youngest child, Sissy.
The cook says, you're the one who ran off with that rock band. And don't think we don't remember. You're the kind.
Yeah, we remember you. You're the kind we remember.
So cold. Now, have you seen this happen, a fallen woman return home?
I've seen fallen women not only return home, I've seen them triumph. My mother gave birth to an illegitimate child at the age of 15 and simply had to walk through Greenville County for the rest of her life with everyone knowing what she had done and stand up under it at a time when that was a large weight to carry. That was the unforgivable sin, was to have a child out of wedlock. Late 40s, early 50s, impossible. And she did it. She did it with a great deal of grace, but with enormous damage. The kind of muscle that it takes to be despised and not despise yourself. That's what I was looking for in the women in Cairo.
And you were the daughter who heard the whispers following your mother?
Oh, yes.
Like what?
I remember being 7, 8 years old and putting up a lemonade stand and having the little girl next door come tell me, nobody's going to buy you a lemonade because you're a bastard. Going in to tell my mother that and watching her face because there was nothing she could do.
What did she tell you to say or do or think?
She said, I'll buy you lemonade. Bought the whole jar and brought me in. She told me never to be ashamed of myself. She told me that people will have all kinds of opinions about who you are and what you do. She said, you just stand up. Don't let them back you down. And that's pretty much what I watched her do.
Now, how did you understand, or how do you understand now, people like the cook who don't, I suppose, reconcile these contradictions? This person was hating Delia for leaving a man who was basically about to kill her and leaving her children. Despising a woman for saving herself, but they also hate the men who are violent to the women. I mean, it's such a contradiction, but those two things exist at the same time in mm-hmm. people who condemn women like this.
It's kind of interesting that we can forgive men. We find it really difficult to forgive women in that situation. The woman who runs, especially a woman who runs and leaves her children behind, is just, that's unforgivable. And I think that's the trick of it. None of us ever really believes it was as bad as Delia knows it was. If you were living in Delia's head, you would understand why she ran. But everybody else, looking at it from the outside, thinks she should have thought, she should have made a plan, she should have been more rational, or she shouldn't have married him in the first place. I don't think we really understand violent relationships in any complex way. And we hold the women responsible, even though at this point in time we have so much more information. We still, a mother, that kind of, supposed to be the paragon of virtue, supposed to hang in there. And the one who runs, we don't really understand.
When Delia goes home, she repents. She has this what you call season of repentance. And there's a very touching moment when she comes home. She's been attending a Baptist church for a while. She's completely destroyed. But at one of these services, an old lady touches her. She uses Delia's shoulder to push up out of the pew. And this is taken by everyone as a sign of or a promise of forgiveness. Is that mm-hmm. something that would have been noticed by everyone in a church and in a small town like Cairo, that one of their own had touched a sinner?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. They're watching them all. That you can't imagine what it's like to be the sinner in a small town, to wear that public cloak. They watch you every minute, every minute. And the woman who touches her is a woman of virtue, one of the older women in the church. And she touches her purely because it is so evident that Delia has suffered so completely. They never forgive her when she runs off and she's with the rock band and she's living the good life. But the woman who has come home and is destroyed and is publicly suffering, that woman they can imagine taken back in, partly because she makes such a great parable. They can show her to their daughters and say, look, look, that one, she was doing good, but look how God has brought her down. Yeah, they love her.
It's a walking Bible story.
Yes. The trick, of course, is that Delia is a strong-willed woman. She would never have asked for their forgiveness. She couldn't make herself do it. All she really does is fall completely apart, and the women friends in her life take care of her, and they drag her to church every Sunday, show her suffering, because they know that's the only way for her to win a place back in that town. Delia herself, if she was herself, wouldn't be able to stand it.
My guest is novelist and poet Dorothy Allison. Her novel, Bastard Out of Carolina, was a bestseller. It was also nominated for the National Book Award. Her other books include Trash, a collection of stories, and a book of poems called The Women Who Hate Me. Her new novel is Cave Dweller. We're going to talk more after the break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Dorothy Allison. Her new novel is Cave Dweller. A beauty salon figures pretty prominently in this book, Cave Dweller. Delia takes over the lease on the beauty shop. I really like how you write about this shop, how hair salons in these small towns, probably really anywhere, are, as you put it, all about dreams and lust and the approximation of a fantasy. That, you know, doing up your hair like a movie star for the prom or Saturday night is a really big deal, and probably the only time that women feel safe in these towns being sexual, talking about sex.
Oh, true. It's safe country. Well, you're there to be reconstructed. You're there to be put in the hands of other women who are going to make you the best you can be and send you out into the world with all that hope. It is a dream. It is a fantasy.
You know this beauty shop scene firsthand?
Oh, Lord, yes. Oh, Lord, yes. Well, my mother, when I was a girl, my mother earned money by doing women's hair in her home. She wasn't a beautician. She was a waitress, but she was really good at it. So women would come to her to have their hair done. And my sisters inherited her talent. One of my sisters worked for a long time as a beautician, and I would go to watch her.
Now, did women really talk about sex when they were getting their hair done?
Oh, of course. Uh-huh. It was women's country. It's like men had clubs, women had beauty parlors. And you think about it. You're laying back. Your head's all greasy and warm. Somebody's had her hands on your face. You're like laying in your mama's arms. You talk about anything. And any woman past adolescence is going to discuss that subject they're not allowed to discuss on the street.
Now, what were you taught about sex growing up?
That it was dangerous. That it was woman's responsibility. That you could never trust any man anyway, but never mind.
Now, you've written, of course, a lot about your family and your books. Your stepfather physically and sexually abused you. Did you have a religious rationale as a child for the abuse, given the contradictions of what people did and didn't say about sex?
No, I didn't. I used to think God wasn't looking. That's the only way it could possibly work. God wasn't paying attention to us. And I got fairly angry about it. I used to try to imagine what it would take to get God to look at us, give justice to us.
Did that mean in your mind that you weren't worth it to God to look at you?
Exactly, exactly. And I don't know any answer. I'm sure that no one intends that whole sections of the population, especially young girls, believe themselves beneath the glance of God. But that's exactly what it feels like. It feels like there is sanity, there is law, there is justice, but it's for other people.
Now, if you didn't have a religious rationale for it, what rationale did you have in your head?
Oh, man. It's unfortunate that one of the given myths of the working class is that men can't help themselves. Men are dogs. Women are responsible. And it's the same ethic that makes it impossible for women to really have full use of their own lives, because the whole job of a woman is to somehow contain, corral, and mystique a man into being better than he intends. I don't believe it now, but it is pretty much what I was told as a girl. I think a lot of girls were told it in the 50s, 60s, early 70s. I think it's one of the things the women's movement changed, which was simply a demand that men take responsibility for their full lives, not leave it in the hands of the woman who's going to fight them off.
Now, your mother wasn't able to protect you in this situation. Maybe you've settled this in your heart, why she did what she did long ago. But in writing this book about a battered woman trying to redeem her past and her relationship with her children, were you putting yourself back in your mother's place again? Did you come to a different understanding of what she did and who she was?
I think just because of the changes in my life, I had come to a different understanding. There's no answer to the tragedy of my mother's life. My mother spent her entire life trying to be a good Baptist woman, to save her husband, to redeem him, and believing that that was her job, her lot in life. She did everything she could to protect and care for her girls, and she believed herself to have failed, and in many ways she did. In other ways, more basic than I can ever explain, she didn't. She literally saved our lives over and over again. There's no justice in what was demanded of her. I don't know anyone who could have lived that contradiction and answered it. If you're not given the option of leaving, which she didn't have, she couldn't, she was a good Baptist woman, she couldn't leave him, then you compromise every day of your life and eventually you destroy yourself. I wanted to write a book about a woman who leaves badly, who leaves broken, who fails, and then through sheer stubborn will and with the invaluable support of the other women in her life, her women friends, goes back, saves her children, retakes her own life. She does it at enormous cost, but I know women do it.
Have you forgiven, in any sense, your stepfather?
Forgiveness is a large concept. I have tried to understand, and I'll tell you the truth, I think I have failed. I think some of the reason I have created the men characters that I have written is an attempt to understand. But I genuinely don't understand a man who is violent with children, a man who would break the heart and soul of the woman he loves. I've never quite gotten to that place of understanding. I have tried not to do myself any damage, and I decided long a time ago that thinking too much, pushing too much at this knot, does me a damage. So I don't keep him in my mind. I don't wish evil on him. I've put him in another place. That's as close to forgiveness as I can get. I think sometimes we talk a little bit too easily about forgiveness. I'll tell you the truth. One of the reasons I wrote the book I have written is to show how long and complicated it is to forgive someone, how much work it takes, both to forgive and to earn forgiveness.
Is it something you see yourself still working on in regards to him?
I try not to think too much about my stepfather. There are dark nights when I do. And like I said, I don't understand him. I have no way to touch his heart, and I'll tell you the truth, I don't want him to touch mine. there's too much pain there. No, I've made myself a place of safety. It's a lot easier to write fiction than it is to change your own life.
Now, you said that this book, Cave Dweller, was a way of proving or working out for yourself whether forgiveness can actually happen.
Yes.
Where do you get to at the end? Where did you get to at the end of writing it?
I got to the where I began to believe that not only could forgiveness actually happen, but that you could learn to trust love. One of the things that is common to all of Delia's girls is that none of them trust anybody. They don't trust themselves, and they do not trust love itself. And a lot of it is because they watched their mother with Clint, and they saw the damage that was done there. This happens a whole lot more than we talk about, that young girls grow up believing that there's this myth of love, but there is no reality, and that you have to go armored into the world. I began to believe, after I worked my girls up, you could love, that there could genuinely be people you can trust with your heart.
Now, in all of your writing, your public persona and your private life have merged so often. It's interesting to me how you would decide what to keep for yourself.
You know, I've never thought of having a public persona. I don't separate off that way. I'm a child of the 60s and early 70s, and we were all trying to live our one life and not be different at home or in the world. Didn't want to have that mind-body split or separate up. So I've never thought that there was anything in my life I could wall off. And actually, I learned very early on that because of a lot of the circumstances that I've grown up in, I couldn't afford to be ashamed. I couldn't afford to start hiding things about myself. So I've had to be very matter-of-fact and blunt about subjects that lots of people don't even want to hear about. Sometimes I don't want to talk about. But I don't dare start playing into that place where fear lives. I don't start hiding. But I know that, particularly the last few years, I've made a pact with my sisters not to talk about their children. I try not to talk too much about my son. It's going to be hard enough for him in the world. I'm trying to imagine that there are places where I don't need to drag everybody. It gets a little complicated.
Dorothy Allison, I want to thank you so much for talking today.
Thank you.
Dorothy Allison's new novel is Cave Dweller. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, in China in the early 1900s, a rich merchant converts to Christianity. His three wives are not happy. We talk with playwright David Henry Wong about his new play, Golden Child, which opens on Broadway next month. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Madonna's new CD. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Having played Evita Perón in the movies and given birth to a daughter in real life, Madonna is back with a new pop album called Ray of Life. Much of the CD incorporates elements of a currently fashionable style, electronica, modified to fit Madonna's voice and ideas. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. This is the title track.
Recent interviews with Madonna never fail to mention two things: her daughter, Lourdes, now 2 years old, and Madonna's current infatuation with yoga. Childbirth and a new regime of meditation and exercise have resulted on this CD in the musical version of A Radiant Glow. There's a luminosity to some of the songs on Ray of Light that's never been present in her work before.
You only see what your eyes want to see. How can life be what you want it to be? You're frozen when your heart's not open. You're so consumed with how much you get. You waste your time with hate and regret. You're broken when your heart's not open.
Throughout Ray of Light, Madonna is collaborating with the producer William Orbit, well known in the dance music world for his eerie, intense remixes of songs by rock acts ranging from Prince to The Cure. Over the past year, major pop figures like David Bowie and U2 have had a crack at electronica, but the results sounded stilted and forced. The icy fluid textures of this genre are much more natural surrounding Madonna's voice, though. She's always been a dance music devotee, and she slips into the rhythm of this sort of music. She's at ease, playful, on a sexy song like Candy Perfume Girl. Any one song that sums up what Madonna is trying to get across to us at this point in her career, it's the one called Nothing Really Matters, in which she wants to suggest that she's become the opposite of her old material girl image. The song is clearly addressed to her daughter, and its sentiments are the kinds of things you hear from so many first-time parents, that sudden realization that you've been selfish, or at least self-centered, that a baby forces you outside of yourself. The ideas may be commonplace, but they're no less true in a good song like this.
When I was very young, nothing really mattered to me but making myself happy. I was the only one. Now that I am grown, everything's changed. I'll never be because of you. Nothing really matters. Love is all we need. Everything I give you all comes back.
silly to take the lyrics of that song at face value. Somehow I don't think that Madonna is spending her days changing diapers and denying herself pop star pleasures because nothing really matters except love and happiness. You notice that when she says what she really likes about having a baby is that when you give it love, it, quote, comes back to you. With Madonna, everything comes back to Madonna. But frankly, that's one reason I like her and enjoy her work. For someone so wrapped up in the reality and myth of the life she's created, she also knows how to give other people a lot of pleasure.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly.
Put your head on my shoulder, baby. Things can't get any worse. Night is getting colder sometimes. Life feels like it's a curse. I can't care.
Coming up, playwright David Henry Wong talks about his new Broadway production, Golden Child. David Henry Wong's new play, Golden Child, is based on stories his grandmother told him about her childhood in China growing up in the 1920s. Wong made tape recordings of his grandmother when he was just 10 years old. Her father, a wealthy merchant with three contentious wives, was the first in Wong's family to convert to Christianity. David Henry Wong has written a number of plays, screenplays, and libretti, including the Broadway hit M. Butterfly, which won a Tony Award in 1988. Golden Child is slated to open on Broadway on April 2nd. Wong says he realized in researching this play that his great-grandfather's conversion to Christianity was part of a larger social movement in China at the beginning of this century.
You know, in China, in that period, right after the Manchu dynasty fell and the republic was set up, I think a lot of forward-thinking Chinese were grappling with the question, well, what is a model for the new China? And in trying to find ways by which the society can move ahead, people tended to gravitate towards Western models. Some people gravitated towards Marxism, some people gravitated toward Christianity, and some people a combination of both. So that Christianity at that point was actually as much a means to move ahead in social progress in the minds of some Chinese as it was a religion. And I think that the play attempts to make the distinction between Tiang Bin, the father, the patriarch figure, who goes into Christianity for reasons which perhaps are more social and practical and political, and then the impact that it has on his daughter, the character that would be my grandmother as a young girl, and that same ideology, the way that it impacts on a young child's mind to make it a more sort of fundamentalist, more extreme kind of version of the religion.
Your father converted to Protestantism before your parents married.
Right.
Did that resonate in any way in your family? Also, was there any conflict in their marriage or in your family over religion?
No, because my father sort of just said it was okay. I mean, there wasn't. He didn't really put up that much of a fuss. My father was, you know, came to the States. I mean, both my parents are immigrants. My father came to the States, and he was interested in becoming Western. He was sort of in love with America. He wanted to be an American. So the idea of becoming a Christian didn't seem to be that difficult for him. I have to say that subsequently, at the time that I stopped becoming a Christian, or, you know, became dead again, as it were, in college, I thought, well, this is such a radical move, and it's so, you know, it's really horrible because I'm the oldest in my generation. Nobody had ever done this thing before. But since that time, various others of my family members, including my father, have sort of slacked off. So I don't know, you know, I guess it might have been more important to my father at one point in his life than it is now.
What did it mean to your father to, quote unquote, be an American?
I think that he saw it as a way of I think he equated success probably with being an American. That is, he was a second son of his father and therefore wouldn't have gotten as much as his older brother. And so he saw America as a place to go to get his, as it were, and that perhaps he always felt that he was falling short of the mark of what it means to be an American until he actually did achieve some success in his business. And then ironically enough, I think now that he's achieved some success, he's maybe less interested in what it means to be an American.
Growing up, did you really want to just be American, not a Chinese American?
I would actually say that I wasn't even that aware of being Asian when I was growing up. On the other hand, it always strikes me that as interesting, you know, that one of the things, if I would see an Asian character on television or something, I would always immediately change the channel. Or if I knew that there was, you know, that there was going to be a movie with an Asian theme, I wouldn't go see that movie. And I think even then, I was feeling the kind of disjunction between these images, which would be associated with me because I knew they looked like me and yet did not seem to be me. And that, therefore, the conflict between one's outer self and one's inner self. And I think it's natural that as a kid, you know, you sort of want to be like everybody else.
If you're just joining us, my guest is playwright David Henry Hwang. He won a Tony Award for M. Butterfly. His new work, Golden Child, is slated to open on Broadway on April 2nd. You're perhaps best known for writing M. Butterfly. It's based on the story, for those of you who don't remember, of a French diplomat who carried on an affair for nearly 20 years with a male Chinese spy who the diplomat believed or claims he believed to be a woman. What first drew you, David, to the story? Was it the political and the cultural elements or the sexual issues?
Well, I think when you hear a story like that, which I did at a cocktail party, I mean, it's actually the sort of story one would hear at a cocktail party, you know, just it's so intriguing. I don't know if it was the political issues or the sexual issues initially. It's just as a story, it makes you go, well, you know, the diplomat claims he didn't know his lover was actually a man. Well, how could he not know? As I started to get into it, I didn't actually research it very much. First of all, there wasn't that much to be known. I mean, there had been a sort of a press release that had been published through in the New York Times, which then had gotten picked up, I think, by other wire services. So any place you looked, I just found the same information that was in the New York Times article. But I, you know, I thought about the question a lot, and it just seemed one of the things that struck me initially was that the story seemed oddly credible, and although one's initial reaction is, well, this is an impossible story, there was another part of me that felt that this made sense.
When you say the more you thought about it, the more credible it seemed to you, what made it credible?
I guess it's that I feel like there's so much, there's so much misunderstanding between East and West, and so much kind of sexual stereotyping that goes on, as well as other sorts of stereotyping, that in some way it seemed to me that a mistake of this magnitude was almost inevitable. That, you know, I think we, as Asians, we're aware of that there's, you know, what are called guys with yellow fever, which is, you know, white guys who are, like, really interested in Asian women. And in the gay community, there's, I think they're gay men who are really interested in gay Asian men, at least at the time, there was a slang term for them called rice queens. So there has always been this sort of sexual fascination on the part of the West on for the East, and a sort of feminization of the East, which is part of the whole allure. Which is typified by Madame Butterfly. I mean, Madame Butterfly is sort of the template for the whole idea of this submissive Asian woman who's self-sacrificing and who wants to be abused on some level. And the appeal that has for men and for the West.
Because the stereotype is so compelling?
Yeah, because the stereotype blinds you to seeing the actual person. Carries on an affair with the stereotype rather than carrying on an affair with a human being.
Have you in your life found yourself fighting against the expectations of what Asians are supposed to be? For instance, good at math or science or music?
Yeah, I actually was a violinist, so I sort of fell into that category. But I think sometimes I wonder if some of the decisions that I've made in life are not simply reactive. I mean, there's, you know, I've made the decision to be a writer, for instance, partially because it was something that would go against the expectations, go against the stereotype of what people might expect of me. I mean, I don't know how much truth there is to that. But in general, I find it kind of interesting if I drive onto the Paramount lot or something and somebody assumes that I'm there to fix the computer. There are things that we carry with us and people make these assumptions. And I think I fight them the same way that all sorts of people fight different assumptions that are made about them.
You wrote a farce a few years ago called mm-hmm. Face Value,
right.
And it was inspired by the controversy over the Broadway musical Miss Saigon and the casting of a white actor in the role of a Eurasian. Mm-hmm. I'm curious whether for you in your plays, it was always a policy to cast a Chinese-American actor to play the role of a Chinese character.
I have always had a policy, but that's not actually exactly the policy. The policy for me is to cast Asians as Asians. In other words, if I have a Chinese-American character, it doesn't matter to me if the actor is, you know, of Korean descent or of Japanese descent or whatever. And I sort of make the analogy between white actors. That is, if you're casting, if you're doing Sophie's Choice, you can cast Meryl Streep in that role, and she doesn't have to be Eastern European. And similarly, I feel that that situation should apply to Asian actors as well. Now, I mean, ideally, it seems to me that anybody should be able to play anything. And this has always felt to me like sort of like the question of affirmative action, which is that, you know, ideally, one, there shouldn't be any laws that have to do with race, and we should be able to live in a completely colorblind society. But I don't think we're there yet in the case of affirmative action or in the case of this of casting.
Now, writing about non-Asian topics for the theater, do you feel that you're taking a risk or that your critics look at it in terms of here is our self-appointed Asian American theater authority tackling a non-Asian topic?
Well, you know, at this point in my life, I'm just so grateful to have an idea for a play. I can't really censor myself and say, well, this is an Asian one or this is a non-Asian one. I've just got to go write it. Perhaps there are critics in certain circumstances that might say, well, this, David Huang is the official Asian-American playwright, and therefore he should only do this Asian-American stuff. But frankly, I have not found that to be the case. I mean, certainly most of the plays that I've done have had some sort of Asian content to them. On the occasions when I haven't, the pieces I've done with Philip Glass, for instance, if critics have had problems with the work one way or another, I don't think anyone has mentioned that it's because I was kind of ethnically incorrect for the job. And there's an interesting thing, I think, that is happening in terms of Asian artists, writers, directors, producers, people behind the camera or behind the scenes, which is that, I mean, if you look at the film industry, for instance, a lot of Asian directors now are not being considered so much in terms of their ethnicity. They're almost being treated the way that European directors were treated a generation ago. If you know, for instance, the idea of Ang Lee doing Sense and Sensibility, or Wayne Wang doing Smoke, or John Woo doing Face Off, these directors are not a typecast in terms of their ethnicity. And I find it, I think that's a good thing. And I mean, I certainly make most of my living as a screenwriter, and I find I'm able to get jobs, as it were, which do not have anything to do with my ethnicity. So that's good in a sense. But I also contrast that with the way that many African-American directors still tend to get slotted into black projects. And I think the disparity is kind of interesting, and it makes me sort of wonder why. And the only thing that I've sort of been able to come up with is that Asians have, that part of our baggage of stereotypes that we carry is this notion of kind of being very artistic and being very, you know, aesthetic. And therefore, perhaps under that mindset, Asians have been given more liberty to be kind of honorary whites in that situation than as many African-American directors have.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us today. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
David Henry Hwang's new play, Golden Child, opens on Broadway next month. Coming up, we celebrate the 25th anniversary of an acclaimed film. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. Tonight is, of course, the night we see how many Academy Awards Titanic sails away with. But there's another movie event we'd like to note. This year marks the 25th anniversary of Martin Scorsese's Mean Streets, the 1973 film set in New York's Little Italy about a bunch of neighborhood hustlers, loan sharks, and low-level mafiosi. Pauline Kael called Mean Streets a true original of our period, a triumph of personal filmmaking. And for many movie fans, it was the first time they took notice of two young actors, Harvey Keitel and Robert De Niro.
Hey!
Giovannino.
How are you?
All right, how are you?
I want you to meet two beautiful young ladies here. This is my good friend Charlie. This is my good friend Tony. He owns the joint. This is, what's your name again, darling?
Sarah
Klein, right? Sarah Klein, this is Tony, and this is what? What's your name?
Heather
Weintraub, right?
I met them in the village.
Bohemian.
Yeah, we went to Cafe Bazaar.
De Niro plays Johnny Boy, a pathologically irresponsible gambler who's dangerously ignoring a mounting debt. Keitel is Charlie, a junior-level mafia thug who's trying to keep his cousin Johnny out of trouble before his problems with the loan shark get out of hand.
Why didn't you make your payment last Tuesday?
What do you mean? I made my payment last Tuesday. What are you talking about?
You paid him last week?
Yeah, I paid him last week. Well, what'd he say? He said I didn't pay him? He's a f***ing liar. Where is he?
You paid him?
Yeah, I paid him.
Last week?
Yeah.
Last Tuesday?
Yeah. Charlie, you don't know where
he's here.
Where?
Out front.
He's here?
Yeah.
So what do I care?
All right, let me go get him. We'll straighten this thing out, all right?
Hey, wait a minute, Charlie.
What?
Well, you're right.
I'm right.
Yeah. Was it last Tuesday?
Yeah, that's the Tuesday. That was last week. That's before the one that's about to come up. My mistake. I'm sorry. Forgive me. It was last week, the week before that I was thinking of, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was, huh?
That's right. What's the matter with you, Johnny? You can't go around people that way. If you're worried about something, you got to keep it.
Hey, you don't know what happened to me. I'm so depressed about other things. I can't worry about payments. You know what I mean? I come home last Tuesday. I had my money, the cash, huh? Blah, blah, bing, bing. I come at home. I ran into Jimmy Sparks. I owe Jimmy Sparks $700, like, for 4 months. I got to pay the guy. Lives in my building. He hangs out across the street. I got to pay the guy, right?
Yeah.
So what happened? I had to give some to my mother. And then I wound up with 25 at the end of the week. And then what happened today, you ain't going to believe, because it's just incredible. I can't believe it myself.
What?
I was in a game. I had like $600-$700, right?
You gotta be kidding.
Yeah, and that's the street. You know Joey Clams?
Yeah.
Joey Scala, yeah.
I know him too, yeah.
Yeah, Joey Scala's Joey Clams.
Right.
Right.
They're the same person.
Yeah.
Hey.
So I was in there playing bankers and brokers. All of a sudden, I'm ahead like $600-$700. I'm really winning. All of a sudden, some kid walks in and the kid yells that the bulls have come, right? Now the cops are coming, everybody runs away. I grab all the money, I go in. It's an excuse, like, to get away.
Right.
You know, and I give everybody the money back later. And that way I get out, I don't have to get into the game and get a losing streak and all that. What happens? I come out of the yard, I don't know this building. Meek, I don't know nothing. Couldn't get out, it was like a box, being like this. So I gotta go back in. Not only do I go back in, but this kid says it's a false alarm. Imagine that. I want to kill this kid. I was so crazy. I wanted to kill this kid. Meanwhile, I got to get back in the game. Bing, bing, bing. I lose $400. Meanwhile, Frankie Bones is over there. Frankie Bones. I owe him $1,300 for like 7-8 months already. He's after me. I can't even walk on Hester Street without ducking that guy.
Mean Streets runs through this Thursday at the Film Forum Theater in New York. It will open in other cities around the country in the coming weeks.
All right. We're not going to pay. We're not paying.
Joey. But why? We just said we were gonna have a drink.
We're not paying because this guy's a f***ing mook.
But I didn't say nothing.
And we don't pay mooks.
A mook? I'm a mook?
Yeah.
What's a mook?
A mook? What's a mook?
I don't know.
What's a mook?
You can't call me a mook.
I can't?
No.
I give you mook. Hey, it's a mook.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Al Banks, Audrey Bentham, Scott Dershinsky, Bob Purdick, and Chris Fraley. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
For tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair. Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.